This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices episode 93 was recorded on December 14th, 2017. I'm Eric Townsend. I've mentioned Juliet DeClercq so many times in recent weeks that one listener actually emailed me to complain, saying, "Dude, either stop mentioning Juliet every 5 minutes, or for crying out loud, get her on the show as a featured guest, one or the other." Okay, fair enough. Juliet will be joining me as this week's feature interview guest, and we've got some really fantastic content for you. Now, normally, we're not at liberty to distribute Juliet's famous graphs and charts because they go to a very limited audience of paying institutional clients who expect exclusive access. But thanks to some sweet talking and advanced planning, we persuaded Juliet to share a fantastic deck of charts describing her 2018 macro outlook, which were already sent to her institutional clients in advance, giving them first access and therefore a leg up, which they're paying for. You're not going to want to miss this chart book, folks. Registered users will find the download link in your Research Roundup email. If you're not yet registered, look for registration and download instructions on our homepage at macrovoices.com. Juliet is one of the most brilliant minds that I know anywhere in the world of macroeconomics, and this was a fantastic interview. Now, because Juliet is French, she speaks with a slight accent, so we accelerated our usual production schedule to make sure that the written transcript of this interview will be available when the show is first released on Thursday evening. So if you have any trouble at all understanding Juliet, the link to the full transcript is in your Research Roundup email. Be sure to stay tuned for our post-game segment after the feature interview, when Patrick and I will continue to mull some of the implications of Bitcoin's explosive growth in recent weeks.
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Eric, we had basically the FOMC, the Bank of England, and the ECB all come out within less than 24 hours. And what we've really seen in the last day is that the S&P 500 is now coming off of its highs, trading now around the 2654 as we're talking. What's your thinking here on the S&P 500?
Well, this sell-off today, I mean, from the open of the U.S. market, really, I mean, it's just a super-duper steep decline. Looks like the beginning of something big. But, Patrick, how many times in the last, you know, several months have we seen that only for it to turn into a 2% or at most 3% dip that gets bought and then yet another move to all-time highs? So I don't see the catalyst for this time to be different. I do think the market's ridiculously overvalued, but it has been for a long time, and it seems to me like it's set to continue. I'm thinking about your ratio call spread trade if we get a little bit lower here, and I won't be surprised if this market continues to power higher. We do have, you know, the new year coming up. Maybe at some point things change, but I think certainly through the end of the year, I wouldn't be surprised if we see a higher high before the year is out.
All right. Well, when we get to that U.S. dollar index, this is really where all the news is, because within about 4 hours after, the U.S. dollar was down pretty good. I mean, we had some heavy selling. The dollar index traded down just to almost to the bottom of the 93 handle. What's your thinking here in the dollar index?
Well, I am increasingly convinced that this is the question of our time. This is the most important thing to get your head around, is where is the dollar headed? And frankly, jury's still out. This entire interview with Juliet is going to be focused on various different aspects of that question, and we'll come back to it at the end. And then, of course, we've got our year-end show coming up with Luke Groman, Mark Yusko, and Jeff Snyder, where we're going to talk about the dollar endgame. That's not a prediction that the sky is falling, but rather we're going to take a level-headed examination of what it will take for the U.S. dollar to eventually be replaced as the global reserve currency with something else, and who's trying to make that happen around the world. But for now, you know, I'm trying to listen to as many expert views as I can. I had been of that view that we were set to see a resumption of the secular bullish move in the U.S. dollar. I still see that argument, but you know, it's not based on thinking that everything is rosy in the U.S. economy. It's really just that the rest of the world is in worse shape. And I think particularly in a crisis situation, if we had another financial crisis, the flight to safety is not going to be into European or even Japanese sovereigns. It's going to be into U.S. treasuries. So I think that there are things that could strengthen the dollar in the longer term. But as far as the intermediate term, I really don't know yet. And I am very much looking forward to this interview with Juliet, as well as what we have planned for the rest of the year.
All right. Well, let's move on to crude oil. Now, literally over the last month, every time crude oil has approached this kind of upper 58 to 59 level, it seems to act like a very heavy overhead resistance. Do you look at this as a big topping formation, or do you think this is just a consolidation before we resume to still yet another higher level in oil?
Well, it's a little bit of both. I very much have been of the view that we were going through a topping process, but boy, I see more and more signs that it's starting to look like a consolidation. You know, what I predicted after the OPEC meeting was this is going to be a sell the news event. And indeed, that was proven true, but only by a couple of dollars. We got down to 55.82, which was exactly the 34-day moving average. That's a big moving average that a lot of oil traders use. And then we saw this very, very impressive bounce almost back up to new highs that has, over the last couple of days, again, sold off. But I expected, okay, this is the time that we're finally going to take out the 34-day and we're going to see an acceleration to the downside. Well, we came back down. We did trade below the 34-day intraday today, but we closed above it. 34-day moving average was at 55.82, which was the prior low. It's now at about 56.70. We closed just about on it yesterday on Wednesday. Today, Thursday, we closed about 35 cents above it. And as we're speaking now, just after 4 p.m. on Thursday afternoon, we're looking at 57 spot 14. And, you know, it looks like we could be seeing, again, the 34-day is really showing a lot of support that I wasn't expecting. Is it over there? Are we not going to see any more sell-off beyond that? I'm still leaning toward the side that we do see more sell-off. But boy, Patrick, I got to tell you, you know, I thought it was a cinch, and it's not been a cinch. We're seeing a lot more resilience here in this oil market than I expected. Let's go ahead and dive into inventory. Crude oil drawing down 5.1 million barrels nationally, 3.3 million barrels being drawn down out of Cushing, Oklahoma. Now, that's a huge, huge weekly draw for Cushing, Oklahoma. But keep in mind, we had the Keystone Pipeline spill. That pipeline is now being repaired and back up in full operation. But I think that last week's drawdown was a result of while the outage was still in existence. Well, those are both really big drawdown numbers. You'd expect that to be very bullish for crude oil. Crude oil actually sold off after the report came out Wednesday. Why? Well, because those drawdowns were more than offset, first of all, by a massive, massive 5.7 million barrel build on gasoline inventories, offset slightly by a drawdown of 1.4 million barrels in distillates. But again, we're looking at another, you know, 73,000 barrel rise to 9.78 million barrels of U.S. production. So we keep just going to new highs in U.S. production. And the reason for that, and I think it's finally hitting people's radar screens, is there's been a massive amount of hedging that's going to lead to more shale production. Rig count is up. And there's a lot of conflicting signals, though. You know, we'll see if we get below 55.82, the prior low. We did get intraday below the 34-day moving average today, but we closed above it. There's definitely been some bullish news flow, though, here, Patrick. Mr. Trump's actions on recognizing Jerusalem has caused a lot of concern about war risk in the Middle East. And then the Forties pipeline is a really big deal. This is a pipeline system. The leak that was found is in Scotland. It basically is connecting the North Sea oil field, which are the oil rigs that are out to sea in the North Sea, and it is pipelining that oil back to the delivery point. Well, that pipeline basically has a crack in it that they discovered, and they announced very quickly it's not going to be shut down for hours or for days. We're looking at weeks to months in terms of how long this thing could be out of operation. That takes about 450,000 barrels per day offline. And I'll come back to that because I think there's some interesting implications that could come out of it. But on the other hand, Patrick, we saw a breakdown of channel support on the RBOB contract. That's the gasoline contract. Now, gasoline tends to lead the crudes in terms of being a price signal. So breaking a major price support channel to the downside, it has significantly lower targets. And if it is true that gasoline tends to lead crude oil lower, that suggests much lower prices for both gasoline and crude oil in coming days. Rig count has been up for, I think, the last 5 or 6 weeks in a row. Production consistently ticking up again this week. And frac crews now have a 6-month waiting list. Now, that kind of spins both ways. On one hand, it does mean that as all of this hedging that's occurred drills a whole bunch of new wells, those wells won't actually be producing oil for a little bit longer than it might have otherwise taken. Because what's happened is where we used to have all these idle frac crews and they were just super cheap because they couldn't find work, now what's left of the fracking industry is basically waitlisted for 6 months, according to Art Berman. So these are all very bearish signals if you look at what's coming in terms of upticks in production. I'm concerned about this Forties pipeline situation, and I think it potentially sets up a feedback loop. What I mean by that is it's already blown out the Brent WTI spread to just super wides. That's going to result in a big increase in U.S. exports. It's also going to result in a lot of oil that was being exported from other countries into the United States being diverted to other markets where it commands a higher price. That will result in more really big drawdowns on U.S. inventory. Now, if you believe in the efficient markets hypothesis, in theory, analysts would adjust for that and say, wait a minute, it's because of this spread. Those are not organic draws in inventory that are a result of supply and demand. There's another attribution. Baloney. If the inventory goes way down, people are going to have a great big supply glut is over party by New Year's Eve, and they're going to be just dancing in the streets that the glut is over. It's not really over, I don't think. I think we have a really big U.S. production surge that's coming. But what I've started to realize, Patrick, is my mental model of this, as I've always said, we're headed towards much, much higher oil prices after the glut clears. I thought we had one leg lower left to go before we started to move higher. And I'm realizing maybe it's backwards. Maybe we're going to move higher from here and get into Q1 before, or even Q2, before we get to the point where that big U.S. production surge hits the market. And at that point, we have the day of reckoning where there's a last purge down to a final low number in terms of oil prices. I don't think it's all over yet, but as I look at the way the dominoes are lining up, I think there's plenty of room to see oil continue to rally from here. Definitely watching this 34-day moving average very closely. If we can get decisively below that, particularly down below the 55-day moving average, well, that really says that the leg lower that I was expecting is on. The more that I'm seeing, though, it looks really resilient, and I really don't know which way this is going
to
go.
All right, well, let's move on to gold, because the moment that U.S. dollar had the reversal in the short-term top, gold made a short-term low and reversed back up. It's almost like intermarket analysis still works. What's your take on gold here?
Yeah, something still works. You know, we got down to a low, I guess it was below 1240, 1237, 1238 someplace. And I think it was really the combination of the miss on CPI expectations and then the FOMC meeting that led to the big recovery that we saw on Wednesday. And, you know, as I look at the tape action here on Thursday, it's not really selling off yet, but it kind of looks like that upside momentum is petered out. And I wouldn't be surprised if we go back and test that 1240 or 1235 low. There's still a support level around 1200, 1210, and I think we're probably headed down to that. The thing that would change it would be if there's a decisive breakdown in the U.S. dollar index. If it breaks below 91, then I think gold takes off to the upside. But short of that, I think there may still be some downside in this market. Another thing that maybe we can come back to in our postgame segment is a lot of people are starting to talk about the question of whether or not Bitcoin is competing with gold for investor demand. And I think that that may be playing a role, although it's hard to quantify. Why don't we save that for the postgame segment?
All right. Well, let's move on to the 10-year Treasury yields, because it's, again, surprising. We have a rate hike, but surprisingly, yields drop, not only on the 10-year, but on the 30-year. So, you know, right now in the 10-year, we're at 235, coming off of a 240 level just earlier yesterday. What's your thinking here on interest rates?
Yeah, we know we're 240 yesterday, but last week when we taped the show, we were at 237. Now we're down all of 2 basis points. What is fascinating me is we're really just treading water without any clear direction or trend at a time when so much is happening in terms of news flow that you would think would be affecting this. If there's anybody who has been just spot on right about the Treasury market this year, it's Juliet DeClercq. So I'm definitely looking forward to seeing what she has to say in the feature interview.
Well, thanks for the summary, Eric. Now, for this week's featured interview, JDI Research founder Juliet DeClercq will be joining us. We encourage you to download the chart book and the full transcript to follow along during the interview. The link was included in your Research Roundup email. Eric's interview with Juliet is coming up as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
And now, with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is JDI Research founder Juliet DeClercq. Juliet is perhaps best known for her fantastic macro charts. In the past, we've been very restricted in our ability to share these charts with our listeners because Juliet's institutional client base expects exclusive access. But we have an early Christmas present for you this week. Juliet put together a fantastic book of charts and graphs, basically painting the macro picture for 2018 that you're not going to find anywhere else. She's already sent them to her institutional subscribers in advance so that they are sure to keep a leg up on the market, which they're paying for. This means we can now share them with our Macro Voices listeners. Registered listeners will find the download link in your Research Roundup email. If you're not yet registered, just go to macrovoices.com and look for registration and download instructions on our homepage. Juliet, before we dive into the 2018 outlook, I want to set the context first with how you've looked at the macro landscape in the U.S. in 2017.
That's a very good question, because one thing I would like to reiterate before I delve into my 2018 outlook in broad lines is that the low U.S. growth potential is not going away, however loud Trump will be in stating the contrary. Let's start on chart one in my 2018 chart pack. Irrespective of other considerations, the one reason to call the U.S. economy late in the cycle is the fact that it is nearing full employment. Of course, full employment is a blessing at the moment, but it will soon become a curse. Needless to say, and it is well understood, that an economy doesn't die of old age. But one thing that can also be taken for granted is that old age doesn't promote good health either. An economy's growth potential is employment growth plus productivity, which on the income side can be translated as employment growth plus wage growth. The issue is that the employment growth will naturally collapse to population growth around 0.5%. The bottom line is that Trump's only chance of boosting growth durably is via increased productivity. Unfortunately, the cyclical component of productivity relies on increased end demand. But the fixes and besieged, of which the Republican tax reform is a main one, focuses chiefly on the supply side, basically pumping up equity prices and hope that the trickling down will work its magic on wages and offset the dampening effect on aggregate demand from lower employment growth. As you can see on chart one, though, the green lines, this is not happening. In fact, policymakers have achieved nothing else in the U.S. in this cycle than inviting speculative rather than productive investment. And the result is that Keynes may turn in his grave, but there is very little left of the economic link that used to tie profits with workers' wages. Afford to buy assets or die is the name of the game.
Keynes may roll over in his grave. I think he's probably doing that for a lot of reasons with what's happened in the last 10 years. The last time, Juliet, that you were on Macro Voices, You linked the U.S. growth to China in a fascinating report titled Red String of Fate Ties the U.S. to China. That was a really fantastic report. By the way, it is still available to our registered users at macrovoices.com in our research library section of the website. So as we get started here, do you still see links from China to the United States?
Well, as you can see on chart 2 and the orange line showing the social financing impulse in China in 2017, the absolute bomb savior this year was the pre-Congress driven credit impulse in the country that was engineered to spur buoyant growth at a key transition time. It did have a rippling impact on the rest of the world through price effects and producer price revival, which more than volume affects directly global EPS growth. The key thing to be aware of, though, is that the post-Congress China may feel very different to the rest of the world. We have started talking about China's reforms and conversion from an investment-based economy to a consumption-based economy as soon as Xi came to power in 2012. But hope for reforms quickly dissipated. And in fact, Xi spent most of his first term consolidating the party's credibility via a clampdown on corruption and also his own authority inside the party. But this has now been a success. And in his second term, Xi Jinping is now expected to use his greatly increased political capital to focus on long-term growth sustainability. This is to achieve his ultimate goal, China becoming the first economic superpower worldwide. The crux of the matter, though, is that long-term growth sustainability means deleveraging. In the past, every Congress has led to a moderation in the credit impulse. The risk is that it is sharper this time, with the likely impact on Chinese imports causing global growth to decelerate. The main impact, though, will be on emerging markets and metals, on which I have taken a negative view since summer.
A topic that we've been hearing more and more guests talk about on the program is inflation. For a long time, everyone said no sign of inflation anywhere, but suddenly we're starting to hear more guests predict the return of inflation. Something else that I've noticed is that different analysts use different definitions of what they mean by the word inflation. So why don't we start with there? How do you define inflation to start with, and what do you see on the horizon?
A naive inflation definition is that demand pull inflation raises when aggregate demand in an economy outpaces aggregate supply. The economy slides along the so-called Phillips curve, employment and wage growth shoot up, and eventually we get to a point where too much money is just spent chasing too few goods. In fact, decades of data show that the changes in core CPI correlate very well with a lag of a bit more than 12 months, with phases of acceleration and deceleration in demand. And this can be observed on chart 12 in my presentation. Demand, in fact, used to correlate very strongly with the short lag with ISM. The issue there, as I touched in your first question, is the growing disconnect between Main Street and Wall Street. Money is accumulated on corporate balance sheet with little incentive to invest in the real economy. And that's because of moribund demand trends. The bottom line is that the money is spent chasing too few assets instead of too few goods, and that means very little real inflation. As an aside, I'd like to add that I see Bitcoin as a symptom of this dynamic, where a long cycle necessarily means lower value, spread compression across the whole spectrum of asset class, and the urge to move towards new perceived value and volatility. But let's come back on inflation. On the wage side, we basically have small businesses that are actually not doing terribly well. And on the chart 10, I use Russell's EPS growth to demonstrate this. I'm using Russell earnings rather than SPX earnings because it is less affected by the weakening dollar trend in 2017. On the second part, you've got earnings growth, which does not really need to be reflected into real income gains for the masses. That's because of new technologies. And the last I was reading on this, just as an example in your area of expertise, Eric, is the advent of the Iron Roughneck robot in the oil and gas industry. Apparently, where 20 people were previously needed to do one task, it now requires 5. This is not even accounting for the fact that those jobs lost to automation get replaced by lower paid service to people jobs. If you add to this the fact that internet and globalization have allowed a strong winner-take-all dynamic to emerge whereby only the strongest and biggest multinationals survive and wipe down the smaller local competition. You literally have to be at the top of the skills pyramid to make it in this cycle. And that's partly where growing inequalities and the divide between Wall Street and Main Street comes from. Irrespective of political concerns, this is big in my macro space. I think Ford was very prescient when he realized at the beginning of the 20th century that mass production can only work in tandem with mass consumption. And it is a true conundrum to see this completely forgotten today. In fact, it may cause the fall of capitalism as we know it, and it is surely a great threat to Trump's re-election as the truth comes unveiled before 2020. For now, though, the bottom line is that inflation is unlikely to surprise positively. And we actually got like 30 minutes ago the last CPI number, which was completely in line with my thinking.
Okay, so how do you extrapolate a strategy from this macro landscape?
Well, setting the real economy aside, the so-called Goldilocks scenario of stable growth and low inflation has been a blessing for the stock market. And I've only started to recommend caution on equities this month. Main Street low real gains allowed low demand and low inflation to keep central banks at bay. In 2017, meanwhile, the strong external backdrop in Asia and Europe, and up to this, the weaker dollar, which helped especially multinationals to thrive. That's the perfect recipe for an equity melt-up. And the reason I've been calling for equity earnings yield to converge to bond yields rather than the opposite this year. And you will understand what I mean if you look at the chart 14 on my presentation. Equities are not in a bubble. The issue, as a recent BIS report noted, is that the earnings yield-based valuation accounts for the permanently lower cost of capital, but it does not account for the shrinking demand that is the corollary. But this was not a problem in 2017, because Trump did bring hope, and with it, the sharply increased leverage that allows the US to currently live above income. And for this, you will be convinced by looking at charts 3 to 7 on my presentation.
Please elaborate, Juliet, on exactly what you mean by caution on equities. Are you saying it's time to raise cash? Is it time to hedge against downside risk or something else? Also, a related question, usually when you see a really big move up in the equity market, as we've seen here, it ends in a parabolic rise to a blow-off top. But we really haven't seen any parabolic acceleration of the move higher yet. So do you think it makes sense to watch for that? Or do you have reasons to think that this equity market might end without such an event?
Well, going forward, what I see is higher real rates, but still a gross purgatory. The issue today is that the hope magnet, as I like to call the tax reform, is virtually gone as the bill will imminently be passed into law. However, the positive direct effect of the tax cuts has already largely been preempted. In my opinion, the tax package and obviously the positive repercussions from European health and China stimulus is responsible for the increased leverage and gross upswing that we've seen in the second half of 2017. And you will see that on chart 7. But the lack of real demand that I described earlier, and which is due to the lack of wage growth and generally growing inequality gaps, has only been temporarily trumped by increased leverage. And you can see the extent of the leverage boost through the credit impulse chart, which I love to use as my framework, and that's on chart 5. This is basically the rise of the animal spirit in the US in 2017. The issue, the acceleration phase is now behind us. In fact, 2018's focus is likely to move to the impact that higher real interest rates may have on the aforementioned increased leverage. And my bet is that the tax boon will eventually be saved. On chart 8, you can see that the corporate leverage, which is expressed there by the non-financial corporate debt to GDP ratio, has now overtaken 2008 levels. On chart 9, you can also see that savings are back to post-crisis low. This is a lot of hope already expressed in real leverage for a reform that was initially promising. That is about at the same time last year, when Trump promised to cater for the middle class. After all, the untapped growth reserve lies in fixing inequalities and unleashing spending power there. Again, I won't risk getting into politics on air, but I think we can all agree that it's not what happened. For a married couple with two kids making $59,000, per year, it looks like the 2018 tax cut will be $1,000. And that, following the House plan, is going to become a 450 tax hike by 2027 and only a $100 tax cut under the Senate's one. If you add to this budget cuts for Medicare and Medicaid, it will soon become evident, even to the non-expert eye, that resources are being transferred from those with highest propensity to consume to those already cash-rich. So I will conclude on this question by saying that 2017 was the year where wheel rates were low and the tax cut an animal spirit magnet. 2018 is going to look different, though. It is likely to be the year when the tax reform main effect is higher real rates applied on increased leverage. In fact, as GDP growth fails to step up meaningfully, what will pop as a concern is the growing fiscal deficit and public debt implications. The risk is that private savings offset government spending in expectation of more, shall I say, taxing times. We will see later that together with the Fed's reaction function that needs to be tested as the Fed slowly gets revamped, this should be worth a 3-5% dip in US equities from January. But that would be a dip to buy unless a few of my radar screens start flashing red for a turn. I'm still not looking for the top. I think the previous blow-off phase were driven by managers, traders, emotions. In a few words, basically animal spirit. Today's markets are different, though, because they're dominated by robots. And that's why it is actually possible that we may see a rounded top rather than a blow-off top.
In your last interview on Macro Voices, you had a very strong out-of-consensus view that the 10-year Treasury should be bought when almost everybody else was saying the opposite. That proved remarkably prescient. I know your clients made a lot of money on that. So give us the update. What happens next?
Well, at the beginning of the year, against the consensus strongly geared to higher yields, I warned about inflation and the fact that it was likely to disappoint. And, you know, if you want to understand why, you should look again at the chart 12 in my presentation. Some of Macro Voices listeners will already know about this, but JDI likes to promote clarity of mind. So I'll reiterate it here. Treasury yields can be decomposed between two components, risk neutral yield and the term premium. The risk neutral yield is the expected return from rolling over short maturity T-bills rate over the life of a longer term bond. The term premium is basically the residual, and it reflects the fear factor. Of course, the million-dollar question is, what moves term premium? Many believe in a powerful supply-demand component, and therefore they also expect substantially higher yields in 2018 on lower official demand stemming from a shrinkage of the Fed's balance sheet and also the ECB's balance sheet. The ECB is likely to be second. My framework works differently and focuses mainly on the change in perceived riskiness of long-term securities as a driver of the term premium. This is because a bond yield really should mathematically be the bootstrap of the expected official interest rate pass over the maturity of a bond. Supply-demand concerns are only secondary. The term premium effectively reflects the fear factor around the central scenario. This unique framework has allowed me to largely ignore, in 2017, the positive effect on the term premium stemming from lower government purchases as global QE programs slowly fade away in 2018. To focus on the likely deflationary effect of the shrinking global balance sheet, and you will see what I mean if you look on the chart 13 in my chart package, inflation has not only become global, but it is also a function of global liquidity. The bottom line is that the supply-demand effect on the term premium is potentially negligible compared to the deflationary impact of a shrinking global balance sheet. This has rightly been reflected through a stable nominal 10-year, an increase in the risk-neutral yield as the Fed tone turns substantially more hawkish in the recent months, and a collapsing risk premium due to clouded inflation outlook. The byproduct of this dynamic has been a much flatter US curve in a move that many characterized as scary when it was actually friendly.
Friendly? Juliet, we've seen a 60 basis point flattening in the US yield curve this year. And you don't characterize that as scary. Okay, when do you get scared? When do you believe it becomes scary?
Well, that's a very good question. And I think it should be on any respectable macro trader's radar in 2018. The US yield curve is considered a reliable indicator of future economic prospects. In fact, an inversion of the curve has preceded every post-war US recession. The yield curve is not only a gauge of market's verdict on the US economy, it also has a direct effect on banks' profitability and lending. A flat curve has a clear transmission mechanism to lending conditions, especially as the Fed balance sheet starts shrinking. This is because it de-incentivizes holding securities over cash, deteriorating lending standards at a time when higher yields start being a constraint to highly levered capital structures and the growth momentum falters could be the kiss of death for the cycle. Especially, as I said earlier, because the current US upswing relies entirely on increased leverage. Hence, what currently appears to be a US strength will, in due time, turn out to be a crucial weakness. To be sure, though, at 35 basis points, the curve is not inverted yet. And curve flattening itself is a natural symptom of policy normalization rather than an indicator of an imminent downturn. Inversion is actually the trigger for the credit tap to run dry. And for now, the credit tap, as described in the Senior Loan Officer Survey, is very healthy. Having said this, the lack of inflation pressure means that a Fed on a continued autopilot and attempting 4 hikes next year, as per the dots, as opposed to the 2 already discounted, could invert the yield curve as early as 2018, at which point the Fed would have to relent or face pushing the US into a recession in 2019.
A lot of people focus on that statistic that the yield curve inversion has preceded every post-war recession. I can't help but notice, though, that the Fed didn't own a sizable piece of the outstanding issue and was not engaged in actively managing Treasury yields in all of those prior post-war recessions. So I tend to fade the yield curve arguments because it seems to me like an apples to oranges comparison when you consider that the Fed is engaged in unprecedented management of the yield curve, which some people would even call manipulation. So, Juliet, do you think that these factors change the significance of a yield curve as a forecasting tool?
I don't think the Fed owns enough of the Treasury market to prevent price discovery, as opposed to the ECB, for example, or the BOJ. And I don't think that it changes the fact that Treasuries are mathematically priced on the expectations of future Fed hikes. That's why supply-demand only has a marginal impact on yields or the yield curve in my framework. And that's post-2013, obviously. Also, the Fed owning a sizable piece of the outstanding Treasury does not change the incentive or de-incentive for banks to lend. Hence, I do think that a flat or inverted curve remains a constraint for the Fed, even if Fed chairs have historically loved to pretend that it isn't.
Juliet, your report last week, which I was lucky enough to get a peek at, was entitled, How Much is Too Much? Can you tell us a little bit more about this? How will you decide when the Fed has gone too far?
Well, the yield decomposition I discussed in your previous question also allows us to observe on chart 15 that the US yield curve flattening has mostly been a function of a lower term premium, which is a risk-friendly dynamic, rather than an actual collapse in the risk-neutral yield, which is a risk-averse dynamic, whereby markets start pricing that the Fed stance has become too restrictive. In a way, the fear of something happening is benign as it loosens financial conditions at a time when the actual risk remains remote. It is when the risk actually materializes that the risk of much tighter financial conditions become more acute. At that point, the risk-neutral yield will stabilize or even start falling. And this is when you want to start selling high yields and equities. For example, if you take the chart 17, which shows the level of Fed accommodation in blue as the distance between the current real Fed funds deflated by CPIX ex shelter and R star as estimated by Loback and Williams model, you will see that in its quest to normalize interest rates despite softening inflation, the Fed has taken an aggressive stance in 2017, and that's mostly due to the lack of inflation. Yet, risk-neutral front-end yields, which you can see in green, have continued climbing, showing no concerns to this date over the much more restrictive stance taken by the Fed in 2017. The most recent communication from the FOMC indicates that the leadership considers the forward level of accommodation. That is, if inflation is assumed to be moving back to target in the time horizon considered, then the Fed stance does not appear overly restrictive and gradual hikes continue to be justified. So if you look at the last thing that Fed Chair Yellen said on 29th of November, she stated that the recent lower readings on inflation likely reflected transitory factors. As these transitory factors fade, she anticipates that inflation will stabilize around 2% over the medium term. Our future Fed Chair is actually more hesitant. On 28th of November, future Fed Chair Powell said, to my surprise, in fact, to all of our surprise, inflation readings started to come in weak. There's a question of whether recent inflation developments are transitory or are there more fundamental things at work here. The bottom line is that the Fed is responsible for the flattening of the yield curve. And it appears, as of now, that it will proceed with its interest rates normalization program, but into a low R-star environment. Hence, continued low inflation means that long-end yields will remain capped. The conclusion is that bouts of curve steepening should continue to be faded. The US yield curve will flatten up to the point where it starts being a strong headwind to a continuation of the cycle in the face of increased leverage and tighter lending standards. Specifically at the moment, I'm looking for 2.5s to steepen back to 40 basis points before recommending flattener again.
So how do I know when the Fed has gone too far?
In a nutshell, a simple answer to the question of how much is too much necessitates to be on constant front-end curve alert. The Fed has overdone its hand when the flattening of the yield curve reaches the point where it causes the risk-neutral yield to stall or reverse. Historically, this has been concomitant with a 2.5s inversion. This is what would be the bad omen that many are looking for to start considering more than a healthy correction in equities or high yields. And you can see the chart 17 and 18 to get yourself convinced on that. The last thing I would like to add on the Fed subject, and that I covered in a November report entitled "A Dangerous Time to be Complacent about the Fed's Shakeout," is that 2018 will see a complete shakeout of the Fed's leadership with a move away from holders of PhD in economics towards businessmen, more likely to be pragmatic. My humble opinion on this is that the curve inversion will be resisted or preempted through a pause in the cycle, using the lack of inflation as justification. The fact that the US is the most advanced developed country in its business and monetary cycles also means that it has the most maneuvering space on monetary policy, and a potential pause in the cycle will remain a strong headwind for the greenback. However, if the Fed remains attached to Phillips' inflation framework, the risk of a policy error will grow over 2018 and the front end of the curve will invert, possibly sending risk assets into a tailspin and forcing the Fed to relent. Those are both scenarios in which the dollar will very much struggle to benefit from a widening interest rate differential with the rest of the world, e.g. the period preceding recession. In short, whichever the ultimate Fed answer is, that is preemptive or reactive, it's unlikely to support the greenback already struggling under the weight of future increased external deficits from the tax reform and the necessity for those to be financed at a relatively attractive dollar level. The consequence may also be that volatility is back.
Okay, hang on. I want to come back to something you said just a minute ago. You think that 2018 will be the year where they stop putting people who have never worked a single day in a real job in their entire life in charge of the global economy. And by that, I mean the academic PhD community. You think instead they're going to start putting people who actually have solid business experience in charge of such matters. Okay, Juliet, I'll bite. They've never really done that before. They've never made that much sense before. Why would they start now? And what causes you to think that 2018 is the year when suddenly real-world experience is going to matter when it comes to choosing Fed governors?
Is it good or bad for the Fed to be run by businessmen rather than economic PhDs? Well, this is another interesting question, Eric, and one that I'll strive to try and nail down in 2018. My first line of thought there is that pragmatism is a good thing. As I explained during this interview, there are many well-documented reasons why the disconnect between workers and profits has happened, and therefore why the Phillips curve is broken, possibly for good. Today, using myself as a pragmatic, I'm thinking that a faster balance sheet unwind and less hikes would achieve a good policy mix of injecting volatility into assets and preventing the formation of bubbles via a much steeper curve while still supporting the real economy. What could the Fed have done better? Let's think of what a pragmatic Fed would have done in this cycle. It should have left the economy rather than asset prices run hot. Shrink liquidity and the balance sheet more aggressively rather than hike rates. The trickling down theory that uses financial asset prices to incentivize economic agents to re-leverage in order to soothe the symptoms of the end of the debt supercycle is clearly an error and one that the Fed will struggle to blame on the government for much longer. In fact, the asset price pump should really only be used in emergency and not after QE1. But let us look at the reason it happened. Fear of seeing inflation expectations collapse in a German-like deflation debt trap. The Fed has given itself a clear 2% inflation mandate. And on this, I should say that I've written a report in July, and it is interesting to realize that the sacrosanct 2% target actually came out of nowhere on a whim. Today's central bank's big issue is trying to achieve an explicit inflation mandate and an implicit growth mandate that are actually not achievable in the mid or long term because of the end of the debt supercycle, demographics, but also, and more importantly, capitalism's fault that continuous growth has its own limits. The bottom line is that our star is probably still negative and that monetary policy making at the lower bound is difficult to navigate. Not printing so much money would have meant a healthier macro environment, but also a lower growth path that has to be accepted politically and has grave consequences in terms of future pension affordability and debt profile. In a way, whether you have a PhD in economics or not, it is easier to bury your head in the sand and pray that the day of reckoning happens after your time, ideally maybe after you're dead. Focus on short-term gains and pretend that the preset mandate is still relevant and achievable. Everyone in the spotlight has interest in continuing to believe that a capitalist model is sustainable. So will a businessman be more courageous and willing to win the economy of its asset price addiction? Nothing is less sure, really. And the real danger is a Fed that is politicized and starts maneuvering the economy following the election cycle. You know, I actually had some forms of hope that someone like Trump would see the opportunity of fixing inequalities to unleash spending power and spur productivity. But what actually got delivered is a narcissist reform package focused on pumping of assets until the next election. I mean, it's really mind-blowing to see that the tax reform delivers tax cuts now at full employment that are taken away after Trump is hypothetically reelected. A Fed that is pragmatic and willing to question models? Yes, for sure. But especially if the longer-term good can prevail at the expense of some short-term pain, which you will have to agree, Eric, has become a very rare species, even in the corporate world. But a Fed politicized would be a disaster for the United States, although probably a blessing for macro traders, as policy errors would abound.
Julia, you already expressed a bearish view on the U.S. dollar, but since I know that your institutional advisory service is geared primarily toward actionable trading advice in a relatively short time frame, I'd like to better understand the time frame of your view on the dollar, and perhaps to expand on that question, I'd like to get your reaction to a very long-term view that we've begun to hear from a few of our other guests who think that the petrodollar system is failing before our eyes and that the final top may be in for the U.S. dollar against other currencies. And by final top, I really do mean final. There are some people who are saying, look, the dollar has seen its peak relative to other currencies, and with the petrodollar system in demise, the de-dollarization efforts of China, Russia, Iran, and so forth, these things are going to cause the dollar to slowly and gradually lose its hegemony over the global financial system, much in the way that the pound sterling lost this status in the early 20th century. Do you think that there's any credibility to such views?
Well, Eric, to elaborate on the dollar, please get the first chart in my dollar section in the chart pack, and I believe it's number 18. To put it simply, the 2017 dollar weaker trend was a catch down on the 2014-15 overshoot, and I framed the recommendation all year as a convergence trade. Monetary convergence, as the ECB started talking of its own QE exit, and the BOJ effectively ran down the amount of JGB purchase using yield curve targeting as the excuse, and also macro convergence, as the US cycle matured and the rest of the world, especially Europe, caught up. This convergence trade has temporarily been put on ice due to the imminence of the tax package being passed and the extra hike it may afford the Fed, but it hasn't gone away. Cyclically, you will see on chart 19 that the late cycle dynamic I described are historically negative for the dollar. And this is the part of the cycle where we will end up in 2018, e.g. either the Fed is reactive and forced to put its foot off the brake to defend the risk neutral yield, or it will preemptively call a pause to blow some wind in the inflation sails. The first proposition is risk negative and will favor euro, yen and gold, whilst the second one will be a broader dollar negative. Some will argue that the onset of recession has in the past been a positive for the dollar, as global capital flows retrench. But this is forgetting one main characteristic of the cycle, that the US net international investment position has sharply deteriorated since the last crisis. You will see on chart 20 that it has moved from being almost balanced pre-global financial crisis to more than 40% negative, 40% of GDP negative currently. Let us not forget that in the 60s, 70s, the US was the biggest creditor to the world. Now it's the biggest debtor. Flows have been chasing dollar carry in the most advanced economy in the global business cycle, but opportunities have largely been harvested now and are now melting, in my opinion. The upshot is that the China, Russia, and Iran de-dollarization efforts are happening at exactly the right time to keep the greenback on its knees. Capital flows to the US have been one way for most of this cycle and are already showing signs of fatigue. The deteriorating debt dynamic will require weaker FX for the deficit to be financed. And last but not least, the GOPS efforts to counter the natural end of the cycle have long lived already. First, the deteriorating debt dynamic will require weaker FX for the deficit to be financed. And last but not least, the GOPS efforts to counter the natural end of the cycle have long lived already and are likely to be dealt a blow by the one-seat majority in Senate following the Dems' victory in Alabama.
Finally, I'd like to talk about your institutional advisory service, JDI Research. Now, you're a boutique firm with only a very small number of institutional clients whom you strive to provide with actionable macro trading ideas. For the benefit of our institutional audience, please describe what your service entails and how our institutional listeners can contact you in order to find out more about it.
Eric, indeed, JDR Research is distributed to a limited circle of professional investors committed to dedicate the necessary time to read the reports and digest them. It's a two-way street. JDI Research provides in-depth thought and analysis, and subscribers ensure they understand it so they're able to benefit from future market opportunities. the reports aim at giving you tradable ideas at the time of release, but also seek to give you the means to react profitably on future events, expected or unexpected. The premium service is even more hands-on, as it involves daily updates on Bloomberg with specific trade advices and analysis on macro game changes. Literally, I am dedicated to allowing my clients to achieve superior profits, and that is the reason why my reports emphasize charts and showing evidence of what I am seeing in the number crunching analysis. It's much easier for traders to get the narrative this way and use it in their investment framework successfully. In practice, it means that I answer subscribers' questions via email in a timely manner, and that the reports will never be blasted out to entire institutions. The limited scope of readership ensures maximum tradability to subscribers.
Now, your service is definitely one of the best in the industry, and it is accordingly institutionally priced. So for our retail audience, unfortunately, no, there's no $500 newsletter that you can sign up for. But I do believe that you've been a little bit more flexible than some of your peers in the industry in that you have afforded discounts on your institutional service to high net worth individuals who are able to afford what obviously is a very elaborate advisory service. We're still talking now about thousands of dollars per year, not hundreds, but for our high net worth audience and family offices and so forth who can consider such services, please tell us more. And of course, my job here is to always look for a bargain for Macro Voices subscribers. So if there's any possibility of a further discount this holiday season, I'd love to hear about that as well.
Indeed, I charge per portfolio manager, which in practice means that anyone taking their investment process seriously should be able to deliver largely enough returns to justify the investment in a JDI partnership. I've really taken a liking to you and Macro Voices and its subscribers as well. And so I'd like to do something I've never done before. That is, give anyone who emails me for a yearly subscription before Christmas midnight, not only a guarantee to be refunded if unsatisfied after 1 month, but also a meaningful discount on the yearly subscription. My email is juliet.declercq@jdiresearch.com. Please contact me.
Now, for people who maybe are not quite ready to step up to the plate yet, is there any way that they could get a sample report to get a sense of what you offer to your subscribers?
Okay, so that will be my second offer. I will exceptionally send the next JDI Research report to anyone emailing me with interest. And again, my email is juliet.declercq@jdiresearch.com.
Well, I get the sense that I've pushed as hard as I can push, so I'll save the third exceptional exception to your policy rules for the next interview, and I really hope to get you back on the program soon because you're absolutely brilliant and I love your charts. Patrick Ceresna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna.
You know, Eric, what a great interview with Juliet. You know, I was fascinated by her comments. She made a great comment saying some will argue that on the onset of a recession, that in the past, it was positive for the U.S. dollar, and that someone that's arguing was usually me. I really had that opinion that, you know, when we get around to the next crisis, that there would be actually global flows coming back to the U.S. dollar and retrenching there during crisis. But one of the things she was pointing out and arguing that it's different this time is suggesting that in this cycle, the U.S. net international investment position has sharply deteriorated And so that may not be the case. It's one of those things that makes me wonder, because I still am standing by my view that I think the U.S. dollar is a safe haven during the next crisis. Maybe I'll be wrong. We'll see. But, you know, I kind of am mulling it over, and I kind of ask the question, well, okay, if the new crisis that comes around eventually originates in the U.S., well, then maybe I could see her argument that the money won't flow into the U.S. But let me ask a question. What if the next crisis origination point is not U.S.-centric? What if the epicenter is China or something in Japan? Or what if it's in Europe? You know, I have a hard time envisioning a period where the U.S. dollar would remain weak in that kind of a period. Am I missing something?
I don't know that you're missing anything, but I think the key to this is distinguishing what happens in a recession from what happens in an outright crisis. And I think the point that, at least as I understood it, that Juliet was making, was if you just see a typical cyclical recession cycle, I think Juliet's making the case that maybe that's not necessarily dollar bullish. And I don't know, I guess that argument makes sense. The place where I don't know that I'm disagreeing with Juliet, but I definitely agree with you, is if we're talking full-on crisis, particularly one that starts in Europe or starts in Japan, I think the safety trade is into the U.S. dollar and into U.S. treasuries. I don't think that, you know, European or Japanese sovereign debt is going to be where the money flows to in a safety trade. So in that case, I definitely see a last hurrah, a big surge higher in the U.S. dollar. But that's a crisis scenario. That's different from just a garden variety recession. So I think that's the distinction I would draw there.
All right. Well, I also wanted to though touch on, because what was great interview, and she touched on this idea of her equity outlook, and generally it was cautious. And I had to completely agree with her in her view that, let's say, the tax package, Europe's health, and China's stimulus has more or less already been priced in. I've always personally been in that camp that believe that the markets are always pricing things at least 6 months ahead of time. So the path of equities from here on is not about this tax package, but it's about what is going to be emerging in the first half of 2018. And to be honest, I'm finding it very hard to find what's the next stimulus, what's the next little thing that will drive equities higher in that first half of 2018. What's your thinking on that?
Well, it's funny that you think about it that way, because I have very similar thinking, but from a very different perspective. I don't think in terms of what the catalyst or stimulus is to drive it higher. I think that what drives it higher is continuing momentum, mania, basically. The people are buying stocks because they're going up. You're seeing a lot of millennials get involved in stock investing for the first time because they don't want to miss out on the upside, and they don't really think about the fundamentals and so forth. So I think that what's driving it higher is continuing momentum, and I don't look for a catalyst or a causal factor to make it go higher. What I do look for really hard is, what is the catalyst that's going to change it? What's going to turn it around? What's going to bring about the next crash or major sell-off? And I think that something has to shatter this confidence. There are so many people that are just convinced that the stock market's going to go up forever. And frankly, it's been going up for so long that there's a lot of people who, you know, unless you're a fairly experienced investor, it's been going up just all the time in a straight line for as long as you've had anything to do with markets for a lot of people. If you're one of those people, something's got to shatter that false reality and get you in touch with real reality. What's that going to be? You know, we had the credit crisis basically triggered by the subprime mortgages resetting. It wasn't about the whole 2008 event was not just about subprime mortgages, but that was the trigger that really was the wake-up call to get people out of irrational exuberance. What's it going to be this time? So I'm looking for the catalyst for the downside, and I think that there is no catalyst for the upside. It's just continuing momentum.
All right. Well, was there anything else that stood out for you in that interview?
Just that I really am impressed by Juliet's process, the way she decomposes treasury yields into the two underlying components that drive them. I don't think I've ever seen anyone else break down treasury yields that way. And to me, it's a very useful framework for how to think about treasury yields and what they mean. And particularly if you listen to some of her analysis, she talks about which component is really driving a change in yield, and that tells her about what it means and where it's likely to lead the market. So I was fascinated by that aspect of the interview.
All right. Well, without any ado, let's get back to Bitcoin, because how can we not be touching on this week in, week out in the midst of this amazing price action? Well, you know, what's interesting is once these futures started trading this week, the price has surprisingly stabilized, at least relative to what we've seen in the past few weeks. You know, and while I generally remain quite skeptical of the story, you know, I wanted to kind of approach and looking at this kind of big forecasting everyone makes for Bitcoins and actually ask the question of what it would look like if what they anticipate actually played out. You know, so I wanted to create a hypothetical scenario here. So let's just assume that all of these Bitcoin bulls are in fact right, and that Bitcoin from here just rips higher sevenfold, and we, you know, are way north of $100,000 a Bitcoin unit, and the valuation of Bitcoins is north of $2 trillion, right? So what? Here's my conundrum. Right. So now today, now I'm going to round the numbers. Okay. But right now, about 40% of Bitcoins are owned by about 1,000 people. So that would imply that in this fantasy scenario, that 1,000 people would be controlling close to $1 trillion of value of Bitcoin. Now, if you go further up that pyramid, there's about 100 people, more or less, again, I'm rounding, that control about 20% of Bitcoin, which implies that close to $500 billion of Bitcoin value would be controlled by, you know, give or take about 100 people. Now, these 100 people would instantly become new cryptocurrency oligarchs, many of them with a net worth of over $10 billion. So I ask the question, who are they? Some of them are entrepreneurs, like, you know, the Winklevosses, or libertarians, or early adopters that began mining this stuff very early. You know, yes, and there are these types of people, but in that mix, there's potentially newly empowered criminals or money launderers that are in there. And so under what fantasy land does someone believe that the governments and the major power players in the world are just going to sit around and let these tax-dodging oligarchs go around unchecked? Under what scenario could they exist where this would not be cracked down on ending this charade?
Well, I mean, I'm happy to entertain your hypothetical, but I don't think it's realistic. I think long before you get to that point, it gets shut down. And I've predicted this for a long time. We're at a point now where Bitcoin is big enough in terms of its overall valuation to get government's attention. And it's a matter of time before they shut it down. I predict that governments will steal all of the best innovations so they can use them to invent their own state-backed digital currencies. But to think that this just continues, and it's I've been reading so much nonsense on the internet this week, people having this fantasy that that Bitcoin will replace the US dollar as the world's reserve currency. Look, first of all, it's completely unrealistic to expect a currency system that is limited, hard capped at 21 million Bitcoin, to scale up, and it doesn't have the ability to transact, what is it, 10 transactions per second or something? It can't even begin to meet the need for international capital flows to do that. But it's driven, I think, by a pipe dream. The early adopters of Bitcoin have this idea that the concept of cryptocurrency is so cool that it's going to take over the world, and they're going to get rich, rich, rich on it. Well, they got a lot of that right. This concept of digital currency is so cool that I predict it will become the next world reserve currency after the US dollar. But it's not going to be Bitcoin. Bitcoin is the Palm Pilot of cryptocurrencies. Palm Pilot was the thing. Anybody who had one was just, you know, slicker than shit until the BlackBerry came out. And then the Palm Pilot was just a forgotten relic, and it was all about the BlackBerry. And that lasted a couple of years. And iPhone was not really a profound difference in terms of technology capability beyond BlackBerry. But I think Apple, because of its market stance, was able to kind of monopolize the smartphone business for a long, long time with the iPhone. But even, you know, that's over too in many ways. A lot of the most tech-savvy people that I know just roll their eyes at the mention of an iPhone. They're all off to the latest version of Samsung or the latest Android phone or the latest whatever it is. So you know, I think that it is a very realistic possibility that we are in the infancy of a new age where digital currency will become the new world currency and the new global reserve currency, but it ain't going to be Bitcoin, and you're not going to be, you know, the guy who owns half the wealth on the planet just because you happen to be one of these thousand people that was an early adopter of Bitcoin. So, you know, it's probably going to continue. Right now, Bitcoin is definitely where the action is. It's what's getting all the press. The other cryptocurrencies, Ethereum, from everything I understand, is better designed in many ways, but it's not getting nearly as much press attention as Bitcoin is. So Bitcoin is going to continue to be the thing until it's not. And whether it falls over under its own weight or gets outlawed by governments first, I'm really not sure. But its days are numbered. And I think that if you're one of those thousand people that are hoarding and, you know, kind of holding out, dude, diversify. If you're worth millions or hundreds of millions of dollars secretly in Bitcoin that nobody knows about, figure out how to diversify at least 10 or 20 million of that into cash so that you're still a rich guy when this Bitcoin fiasco is over, because it's a charade and it's not going to last. I don't know how it ends, but diversify some of that wealth out. And I certainly don't begrudge anybody who has, you know, made a lot of money on Bitcoin. That's fantastic. My hat's off to you. You picked the right thing to gamble on, but it is gambling. It's not investing. There is no intrinsic value in Bitcoin, and it doesn't have fiat value. It doesn't make any sense. And it's also now, in all history, in terms of percent appreciation, just this week, Bitcoin has eclipsed the Dutch tulip mania in terms of being the biggest bubble in recorded history. Now's a really good time to, you know, if you want to stay with this thing, great, but why not cash out half of your wealth in Bitcoin into good old-fashioned fiat currency, just in case it turns out that us non-believers are proven right and governments outlaw this thing and it ends up collapsing to zero.
Well, you know, Eric, what if one of our listeners is someone who just wants to participate on this upside and just get a piece of the action? And if there's a little bit more to go, how to profit from another little uptick in Bitcoin? What's your thinking on how to participate in this?
You know, that's an excellent question and something I've been thinking a lot about lately. There's a book that I would love to read. I'm not qualified to write it, but I think it would be an incredible bestseller. And it's basically How to Trade Things That You Know Are in a Bubble. And Bitcoin is a perfect example of this. To a lesser extent, the current stock market is an example of this. Valuations are too high. It doesn't make sense to buy and hold it as a long-term investment because you believe in the value investment proposition. But it may make sense if it is in a very strong uptrend to play on that uptrend. Now, I think the people who are going to be most successful in that are the realists, the people who are not suckered into this ridiculous idea that because Bitcoin was the first cryptocurrency, it's going to be the one that, you know, owns the market forever, and the guys that got in earlier are going to be these Bitcoin oligarchs that are billionaires that you're talking about. It's not going to be that. But if you realistically say this thing is in a ridiculously strong uptrend and you understand how to use options, as I understand it, the Bitcoin options are not trading yet, but they're coming very soon. You know, something like the ratio call spread strategy that you talked about works in the stock market, but it works because we have a very suppressed VIX. The thing is, you would get killed on that trade with Bitcoin because although the options may not be available yet, when they are, the implied volatilities are going to be through the roof. So you'd pay a fortune to use that strategy. I would love to see the well-written book by somebody who really approaches this problem systematically of you've got something that is trending strongly, you don't believe in its fundamentals, but you do want to participate on the momentum. Because I'll be the first to admit, Patrick, I am a fool for having not participated in the massive upside that has occurred in the last 2 years in the stock market. And the reason is I don't believe in the valuations. And I'm therefore not going to just be exposed long to the market. If I can find ways, either using a trend following strategy or
an option strategy that allows me to have a very systematically protected downside while participating in the upside, I'm certainly open to that. So if our listeners have heard of such a book or an author or somebody we should interview that really knows how to approach things that are in manias and bubbles systematically and profit from them without getting sucked into actually believing the rhetoric, I'd love to interview that person on the program.
Now, Eric, in the market wrap, you mentioned when you were talking about gold, this idea that, and asking the question whether Bitcoin is actually taking away from gold or somehow that the two are linked and is influencing it. What's your thinking there?
Well, I definitely am pondering this question. I don't think anybody knows. I've read several pieces this week. Goldman had a note out about this. I talked to Jeff Christian about it. You know, people are saying, no, it's really not the same thing because Bitcoin does not serve the same purpose that gold does. I don't think that's what's important. What's important is the marginal buyers of gold, the people that support the price because the trading is on the margin. A lot of gold in the world is held by very strong hands that don't transact it. So it's those transactions occurring on the margin that are driving the price, and it doesn't take a whole lot of demand destruction to change the price. And I seriously wonder if you look at how much mania there has been around Bitcoin, that money that's going into Bitcoin is money that's, you know, not going into something else. It seems like if you saw there was some polls that Ron Paul has done where he was surprised to learn that many of his followers, many of whom are millennials, have come to favor Bitcoin over gold. So it seems to me like probably to some extent, this demand for Bitcoin is taking away from gold and hurting the price of gold. If you think about it, that's a really fantastic setup for a gold investor, because if you agree with me, or even if you don't agree with me, and I end up being proven right anyway, someday if Bitcoin blows up and falls apart, gold's not going to the moon the next day, because a lot of people will have lost money and they'll be shy. They won't have any money to invest. But people will have learned a lesson and they won't be investing in cryptocurrencies instead of precious metals. And you would think that that would cause a slow and steady increase over time. So you don't have to get the timing exactly right. You can wait until Bitcoin blows up and falls apart and assume that after that happens, there will be a slow resumption of demand for precious metals. I don't know that I'm necessarily going to wait to buy precious metals until a Bitcoin collapse happens, but I certainly think that if a Bitcoin collapse did happen, it would be a signal that maybe the direction of gold is about to turn around. But on that note, we are out of time, so we're going to have to leave it there. Folks, we do need your help promoting the program. The more registered users we have at macrovoices.com, the more able Patrick is to recruit the very best feature interview guests. So please go to macrovoices.com, click on the register button, follow the instructions. Only takes a few minutes to register your free account. The benefit to you is that you'll receive our research roundup email, which never contains any advertising or marketing. We're not going to spam you. We're not going to try to sell you anything. It's just a compendium of links to all the coolest free stuff that you can download on the internet, including downloads from our feature interview guests, such as Juliet DeClercq's fantastic chart book this week. Patrick, tell them what's in this week's research roundup.
All right. Well, like you were suggesting there, this week you're going to find the transcript for Juliet's interview, as well as that amazing chart book that she put together to follow along during the interview. There's also, if you haven't watched it yet, a link to the CNBC interview with Jeffrey Gundlach discussing the best ideas for 2018, including a short video where he kind of talks about Bitcoin and his views on the bubble itself. There's also a link to a Financial Post article discussing the 5% fall in Canadian home sales as the new mortgage rules kick in. And I find that really interesting because right here in Canada, they are kicking in new stress testing rules on mortgages. And it's going to be interesting to see how that changes the supply dynamics in the market. Nonetheless, you'll find this and so much more in this week's research roundup. So that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners and are always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and want to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag it with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter, and we'll include it in our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account at macrovoices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter at Eric S. Townsend. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.